Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Welcome to the Muslim Philanthropy Podcast at American Muslim Community Foundation. My name is Muhi Khwaja, and today on our show, we have Warda Khalid, who is the founder and board president of the Polygon Education Fund. Welcome to the show, Warda.
Thank you so much, Muhi. It's great to be here.
Yeah, great to have you on. We've known about each other for the last few years, and I've been able to see your work grow, and it's great to always have on a fellow Amicly alum. And for those that don't know, Amicly is the American Muslim Civic Leadership Institute that's held at the University of Southern California. So we were both fortunate to go through that program at different times, but just networking through the alumni. They have over, I think, 400 or 500 alumni at this point now. So it's really inspiring to see all the different work that these leaders have done across the country. And I feel like one of those like projects that have risen out of Amicly could definitely be American Muslim Community Foundation. And I'm sure there was some influence for Polygon as well. Let us know a little bit more about yourself, where you grew up, family life, school, all that jazz, whatever you want to share.
All right, awesome. Well, thank you so much again for having me. It's great to be here, and thanks for putting together this podcast for the community to learn about different people. So my story is I grew up in Texas. I'm originally from the Houston, Texas area, and I am the daughter of immigrants from Pakistan, Pakistani immigrants. And I was always kind of, I think when you're a child that grows up in the US and where you're not in the dominant culture, you learn to feel different and you know that you're different. And I think navigating that identity is something that many immigrants and children of immigrants face when in the US. And I don't think my story was really any different. The place that we lived in Houston for most of my childhood growing up, starting about third grade, was majority white. There was some diversity, so I was definitely not the only minority kid, but it was majority white. And so I think for me personally, I didn't really get involved in the Muslim civic engagement space until college. And I went to Texas A&M University, and I was really involved in the Muslim Students Association there. I became a sister social officer and really made it my passion to make people really enjoy being a part of the Muslim Students Association and make it fun and to help build kind of that community. Because when I joined, the MSA was kind of very like they would have ad hoc meetings. It wasn't super organized. And so a couple of my friends and I got together and kind of helped revamp it. And I think that was really my first experience working in the Muslim civic engagement space and being involved, because before that I had attended Sunday school, I had taught some Sunday school, and then I had even taught a civic engagement kind of class, or it was like a current events class that I taught at my mosque. So it was like for youth girls that were like in high school or beyond, and I taught it with a friend, and she taught like stories of the prophets, and I taught current events, and it was really like going through my Twitter timeline and saying like, this is what happened this week, what do we think about that? So that was kind of my first venture into it. And I think around the time that I graduated, that was when Islamophobia became a term. It was the first time that I heard it in my senior year of college. And it was around the time that President Obama was elected. And we were seeing a lot of really divisive rhetoric saying that he was Muslim or Arab, as if those were bad things. And that really made me realize that, oh, wow, there's like a disconnect here between what Islam really is about and what people are saying that it's about. And that really motivated me to do something about it. I'm very much a doer personality type. If I see something happening that I don't like, then I try to get involved, whether that's donating, whether that's me personally directing my energies toward it, or even starting an organization, which I did with Polygon. But going back to that time, at the time, mm-hmm. the Houston Chronicle had this religion blog, and they had a lot of different members of different faiths writing blogs. And I noticed there wasn't really any like a young person writing from Islam's perspective. There was like an older convert. And then there was another guy who wrote a lot of kind of theological type stuff. And so I didn't really see anything that could speak to everyday people. So I approached them. I had written for my college paper throughout most of my schooling there and had written for my high school paper. So I had experience writing, and they were nice enough. They're like, yeah, come on. And so that became my thing. I was writing weekly columns called Young American Muslim. That was the title of my blog. And it was really to kind of bridge that gap between, you know, what people were saying about the faith and what I had really experienced as a Muslim growing up. And then, you know, from there, it just, my work just continued. You know, the local care office in Houston needed some help with their accounting. And at that time I was working in accounting at Deloitte. So I offered to help them some, and that turned into me co-leading and co-creating this Muslim Youth Leadership Symposium in Houston. They had it in Chicago, I think. So for the first time they were going to do it in Houston. And putting that together to really teach young people to meet like with members of Congress and people who were working in the civil rights space to see kind of what was out there, kind of beyond the engineering and medical fields that many in our community gravitate toward. That was kind of how I got started, very much at a local grassroots level, helping my community. I was a MENA camp counselor as well. I became the Houston MENA advisor, and that was really fun. Youth really were my passion because I'm the oldest of five kids. I'm very much used to mentoring kids, and it's something that I feel comfortable with. And I really feel that youth are our future and we have to invest in them. So that was really why I got started. And then, eventually then I decided to change my career and go into international affairs, and we can talk about that more, but that's kind of my backstory.
Yeah. I have to say, like, every step of the way where you're talking about like your engagement with the community and getting involved and teaching and doing all these other steps, I'm like, yep. So I think your story is like very similar to the experience of so many other immigrant Muslims that grew up here in the United States. You know, you talked about feeling or knowing that you were like an other. And I think even in, you know, growing up in Michigan, we lived in the city of Livonia, which was once dubbed the whitest city in the United States. And, you know, it's interesting because, like, when you're that young, you don't necessarily, like, feel different, but you know you're different. At least that's how it was for me, right? I wasn't necessarily otherized. But you knew that you weren't different. You knew that you were different because you couldn't eat pepperoni.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, all those little things. So whether it was something as small as that, or, you know, just something that, you know, you grew up with knowing that there were different things about you and your household compared to your friends at school, it definitely brought that sense of identity. And I think for me as well, growing up, it was always that hook of the Muslim community and being involved in the masjid. That definitely was a big part of my identity growing up. But I've also talked to other people who maybe didn't have any of that until college. And the MSA was like a pivotal moment for them to kind of realize that sense of community. So, you know, I think for you, curating that space for other college students is really critical. And, you know, I wasn't on any like positions in MSA, but I was actively involved on campus life in general, and definitely appreciated all the work that the MSA would do.
Yeah.
Especially the social activities. Those were the most fun, right?
I mean, and I think that's important that, you know, we don't just have to be involved in Muslim orgs, quote unquote, in college to kind of have that experience. Because part of, you know, finding your identity is also showing that there is diversity in other spaces that are not just for minorities, like not just Muslim spaces or minority spaces. I was my dorm council's hall president. I was a delegate for the residence hall association. And there were, again, very few minorities in those spaces. I think there was like one or two Asian kids. You know, I was maybe one of two Muslim people. But, you know, putting myself out there, and, you know, my college was listed as like the most conservative campus in the U.S., Texas A&M University. But it was still so important for me to be in those positions because they would see somebody who looked different from them and in a, not necessarily like a Muslim space or a minority space. It was just part of the regular school politics. So I think that's really important too.
Yeah, I think thankfully, like through student government, I was student body president. I was also involved in Amnesty International as one of the presidents. And, just so many different ways. And I think also where I was at, there was a lot of leadership that modeled that, that you could be in those positions of power. I mean, power really, like what power did they have? But like at least like leadership positions,
ceremonial,
you know,
power.
Exactly. So it was good to see that other people before me had accomplished that and that I could do it myself. So I had that in me to have to aspire as a goal. And I think that really shaped who I was and being involved in nonprofit organizations going forward.
My newspaper, being in part of newspaper was the same thing. I remember my MSA president during one meeting, he was like, Wardha, can you come up here and talk about being on the newspaper staff? And like, how did you do it? What do you do? And I was like, oh, wow, I didn't realize that it was so unique that I wasn't on the newspaper staff there. But yeah, I mean, I had done it in high school. It was a very natural thing for me. But yeah, nobody else in the MSA was doing that kind of stuff. So yeah, representation matters and more people need to be in those spaces.
For sure. And I think one of the other, you know, things that I've recognized about you just being like a natural leader, right? Like you, maybe it was being the eldest of your siblings, but I think you do a really good job of showcasing that, you know, leadership and being able to run an organization. So why don't you share a little bit more? You can go into like the international fair stuff if you'd like, and then kind of how that led to a trajectory for Polygon.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, at the time when I was living in Houston and working in the accounting field, you know, I'd always had this kind of dream or vision of myself, even before I started college, to go work in like the UN or like be in the State Department. I think Madeleine Albright was the first woman Secretary of State when I was growing up. And I just saw a picture of her and I was like, I want to do that. Like, that looks cool. I didn't really know much about world affairs. I mean, being the daughter of immigrants, you hear a lot of politics and things like that at home, just natural part of the conversation. But it wasn't something that I really learned about that much, even in college. You know, I was a business major. Most of my classes were business related. I took maybe one poli sci class. And it was something that I think the Islamophobia that I was seeing a lot towards the end of my college career, and as I was blogging and doing all these things in Houston, really helped me realize how much our foreign policy was tied to what's happening here in the US and how Muslims and minorities were being treated. You know, at the time we had gone into the Iraq War, invaded Afghanistan. You know, there was already the first Gulf War that had happened. And there's so many communities in the US were feeling like scapegoated, or they were feeling marginalized because of these actions abroad. And I was feeling really much that US foreign policy was looking at the Muslim world through an orientalist lens rather than a human rights and, you know, a human lens. And so that is what really motivated me to pursue a second master's degree in international affairs. I mean, I started looking at, it was my quarter life crisis. I was 25. I went to Umrah, alhamdulillah, and I was just really like trying to get some guidance on what I wanted to do, because I had this great career that I was doing that had a very solid trajectory and would be a stable career, versus I was spending all my spare time doing community work. And, you know, I finally, I think when I came back, started looking at like graduate school programs, looking at jobs at the State Department, and I saw that all the types of things I was interested in wanted a degree in international affairs. So even the UN, if you wanted to intern there, I think you had to be a student. So it became very clear to me that I'm going to have to go back to school. And I want to do international affairs because I want to learn about something. I already had a technical degree in business and accounting. I didn't need a law degree. I had thought about law school actually while I was in college. And that's why I did business, because I was like, oh, law school doesn't care what you major in. I'll do that and do policy. But, you know, law is another technical degree. And I didn't think that I needed more technical skills. I needed to learn the issues. So I applied to two schools first that both had January admissions. They were Columbia and American. And alhamdulillah, I got into both. And then I really just had to decide where to go. And I just decided Columbia, because I was like, oh, I know I want to end up in DC, so why don't I try living in New York for a bit? And I'm so happy I made that decision. It was an amazing city to live in. I love that city. So while I was there, I did 3 UN internships. And that was one of my main things that I wanted to do there. 2 in the summer. I did one at the permanent mission of the OIC, which is the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, which is like all the Muslim countries. And that got me access to the Security Council, which is very cool. but also very disappointing because I learned that they just go and read statements there and nobody right. makes any policy there. So I was like, yeah. okay, I don't think this is the place that I want to be. But it was still good. I also had an intern at UNDP in the communication side and saw a lot of the great programs that they're working on. And then after graduation, I went to Jordan to learn Arabic further and then also got to intern with UNRWA there, working with Palestinian refugees really on cool. sanitation conditions there. So it was nice to get some on-the-ground experience. I think the UN does amazing work and we should definitely fund them. It just, I think for the policy making that I was seeing in New York, it was not satisfactory for me. So I knew I wanted to come to DC and work there. And shortly after graduating and coming back from Jordan, I got a job at the Friends Committee on National Legislation, which is a Quaker lobby here in DC. And before I even started, I knew, I was like, this is very cool. This is a faith group that is lobbying based on their values. Mm-hmm. And they're doing everything from like domestic to foreign policy. Like, if this goes well, I want to start something similar like this for Muslims. So the idea for Polygon came in late 2014 when I secured this fellowship. In January 2015, I went to my Amicly Summit and announced that I was going to make this Muslim lobby.
There you go.
Yep. Just announced. And you know how Amicly is. It's a very supportive environment and they're chanting for you. And I met one of my co-founders there, Afif Rahman. He was interested in helping out with it. And so that was really nice to have kind of him in the back of my mind as I was learning and planning and putting a team of people together to know that there were people that actually wanted to help me do this work.
Totally.
Yeah. So when I got to DC, I started my fellowship. I learned as much as I could about the lobbying process and how FCNL worked. They had both the 501c3, which is the nonprofit education arm, and then they had the 501c4, which is the actual lobby. And my goal was to actually make both. But what I learned very quickly, because I started doing a lot of research in the Muslim space, I was calling up Muslim leaders and asking them, like, why hasn't something like this happened before? Why do we not have a Muslim lobby? Like, mm-hmm. what's going on? And, you know, part of the reasons that I got was like the community is not there yet. They don't know how to lobby. They don't know these things. And part of it was that, yeah, I think it was like people just didn't have the knowledge. And so that was why we decided, okay, we're just going to start with a 501c3 education piece because we have to build up this kind of grassroots base, teach people about how to lobby, how do you actually do town hall meetings and phone calls and office visits. And so I started training people actually on my own, just in my personal capacity on how to lobby some Muslim groups. And those trainings, eventually when we created Polygon, we moved to Polygon and used to train people all across the country, which has been really cool. So like about 9 months in, I put like a team of people together to help me kind of bring this vision to life. And it was like young Muslim professionals. I think we were almost all millennials. Which is really exciting to have kind of new blood and new energy in the space. And, you know, began a very humble effort to, you know, put something together that could teach people the importance of civic engagement. And, you know, growing up in Houston, there was a lot of politicians that come through and people pay a lot of money to have lunch with them and take pictures with them, right. but then they're not asking them to do anything after. And that, I think, is the big problem. And that's the problem that Polygon tries to solve is really holding your members of Congress accountable. And by the way, the trainings that teach these skills, you can definitely apply them at the local and state level as well. These skills of holding your members and representatives accountable is very much transferable and important at every level of government. So that's kind of how we started. We launched in January of 2017, right after Trump was elected. So the community was very much ready for something like this. They wanted to do something. They were excited that Polygon was in existence. And we trained like, I think 5,000 or 10,000 people our first year online and in person. So we got off to a really good start, alhamdulillah. And since then have just continued doing these weekly Hill newsletters and providing policy guides and resources for the community to learn about what's happening, action alerts as well. So it makes it very easy for them to engage. We give them a script that they can write or call. And it's really, I mean, I use the term spoon feeding the community, and I don't mean it in a condescending way. I just mean meet them where they're at. Like, they don't know what these complicated terms like cloture and minibus and all this stuff mean. Like, I didn't know this before I came to DC. And so we have to remember that our audience is largely outside DC. I think of my community in Houston when I think about putting together these resources. Other board members think of their own respective communities. And that's really how we function. And I think we've grown at a small and steady pace. And this year, alhamdulillah, actually late last year, we finally hired our first, you know, full-time hire of policy and advocacy manager, which has been really exciting because I think that's going to help us grow exponentially. And it's taken a lot of work, and it's taken a lot of time and commitment from the board. And I've been privileged to lead them over these past years and really, you know, try to really inspire people, I think, inspire people that this is something that our community can do, and this is how we serve the community. And, you know, this organization is a great way to do that and build power.
So before we get into like the programs and services of Polygon, I want you to kind of walk through as a founder, like that process of identifying board members, of starting with the work, of disseminating information. Like, what were the steps that you took to kind of launch the organization for people that are interested in trying to start their own ventures?
Yeah, it's a lot of work, and I hope you have a lot of time. I don't think people realize how much work it goes into starting a nonprofit. I'm sure you know who you've done it, but it's a labor of love. That's how I can respond to it. And I would say you really need a lot of passion. If you're not in it for the right reasons, you're not going to last. You're not going to last because it takes a lot of personal sacrifice to be able to do this. It just so happened that after I finished my fellowship at the Quaker Lobby, I went home to Texas for what ended up being a year. I didn't know it was going to be that long, but I was waiting for another job to start. And it just so happened that it was taking a while. And during that time is when I used to put together the incorporation documents, the bylaws. I created the website. And, you know, I was holding these weekly or biweekly board meetings, you know, with some of the other co-founders and really planning like, okay, we want these types of resources on the website. Okay, can you put together a one pager on X issue? And then really like talking to people about, okay, how do I do a press release to announce the launch? Can you help me? Like I had friends that were thankfully were giving me tips and pointers, doing meetings with people in the community that were interested in being advisors. Some of them were in Houston that I got to meet with and talk about. So it was just, you know, I think there's a lot of like corporate or incorporation kind of work that you have to do. Like I was also calling up like the DC, I don't even know what the name is, incorporation, something, whoever does DC incorporation and calling them and like asking them like, okay, what form do I fill out? How do I do this? So it was a lot of that responsibility. Most of that was on me because I was, you know, I was in Houston. I was working, I was consulting and doing consulting work, but I didn't have like a full-time day job. Polygon became kind of my job that I was doing. And so that's really how it started. And then it was about a year long process of, you know, putting the team together. You asked about putting the team together. So I mentioned Afif had offered at Amicly, but there were other members who I would just kind of see or meet through other organizations that I was part of. So one of them was Nadia Muzaffar, who I was on the Muppies board with. And so she was really good at compliance type work because she's an attorney. And so I actually, like, before she even formally joined the board, she had helped me kind of like review the documents that I was putting together. And then before our launch, I think after the election, she really wanted to get involved. And so she joined on that way. So people have different motivations, you know, for joining. Some was in response to the election of Trump. Some were there before. Like Tamim Chowdhury was another one. And he had, I think, previously worked at MGH and was already in this space. So, you know, I think it's really important to have people who can balance out your strengths and skills maybe that you're lacking as well. So I think it's important to build a diverse team, and that really can help, you know, ensure that you have some momentum as you're going. It's never a one-person show. It's always like a team effort.
For sure. And I think all of that is really sage advice. You know, we mentioned Muppies, the Muslim Urban Professionals, that network of thousands of people across the country and diverse set of skills is also where AMCF recruited board members from. So we were able to find some really talented, passionate board members. And I think, you know, like there's so much work to be done, and whether you in the first few years have like an operational board and then get to more of a advisory board for your directors, like that transition takes time. And even AMCF, we're still growing through that. And I think that we're you know, still creating policy documents of like how our organization should run. And there's so many little things that when you're thinking about launching a nonprofit, you maybe don't think of. And I think, you know, it's definitely a labor of love, like you said. But remind me, like you do so much, obviously, but your full-time job is like other advisory roles, right? So you're doing this after hours and like, so tell us a little bit more about how you manage that.
Yeah. So like you said, you know, starting out, we were very much an operational board. We were the ones creating the flyers for events. We were the ones that were delivering the trainings. I had mentioned earlier that I had created the training earlier in my own personal capacity. And so we were delivering that, building connections on the Hill, meeting with other Islamic organizations or civic engagement organizations and helping them with their work that they were having trouble with. It was just, you know, it was very much operational. And then pretty early on, we brought on a fellow, somebody that I had met in DC here. And that was really great to have somebody kind of on the ground doing like the day-to-day work for us. And then our job became more like supervising her and then doing strategy and then continuing kind of these operational things. And then after that, I think in the next year or so, we brought on a media intern. And now it's kind of like part of our thing to always have a media person and a fellow. For sure. And it's kind of how we've set it up. And now, as I mentioned, we just hired the policy and advocacy manager. And we also brought on like these volunteer event and training coordinators to help us manage all the requests that we get for trainings, especially here in this COVID environment, people still want virtual trainings. So it was very much operational in the beginning. I think, like you said, we're also growing through it. And I mean, my board is still meeting very regularly right now because we also had end of the year fundraising and now we've got an operation coming up. So that's a big thing for us. And so it's, like I said, you really have to have a passion for it and really want to make a difference for the community for you to do well. We've been really blessed to have good board members that bring these different skills, whether it's overseeing like writing grant applications or helping oversee all of the marketing work. It's really been, they're very operational. I think only now we've started to get away from that a teeny bit, but even now, like we're still very involved in, you know, if you have a new hire, like how do you set up the accounting? How do you set up payroll? Like our board members are figuring that out. Talking to consultants, of course, but we still have to figure it out. So yeah, you're basically a company and you're kind of doing all of the work and overseeing it at the same time. I guess that's the best way to describe the board.
Yeah. Thank you for going into that detail. Now, when you came up with like a strategic plan for Polygon and kind of like walked through, like these are the core areas of programs and services that we want to provide the community, where did you guys end up and where are you guys in that process continually?
Yeah, we're constantly looking at the strategic plan, probably every like 6 months to a year, depending on what is the kind of feedback we're getting from other organizations, from the community. I think for us, one big thing that Polygon, that I really was in my vision, was to make sure that Polygon was a grassroots-based organization. We have a lot of Muslim civic engagement organizations that are kind of national or top-down, but we don't really have anything that's, you know, on the ground and like really meeting people where they are in community, which is the experience that I had come from. So we are always thinking about that and how do we get closer to that. And I think our trainings are a really great way and are the main way that we're doing that right now. So we want to expand those and eventually have like, what do you call it? Like a grassroots coordinator that can go out and start building teams, like advocacy teams, so that when we do send out an action alert or something, you know, there are people mobilized and like ready to go. So that would be the ultimate goal. But for now, you know, we have to, in our strategic plan, we come up with different scenarios. Like, okay, if we have X amount of money, this is who we can hire. This is what we can do. These are the programs we can give. So it's very kind of practical for us, as well as like, you know, really focusing our mission and vision and making sure that's clear to people so they understand. And I think we have done a good job of that. So if you go on our website, you know, it lists like, these are the two ways that Polygon works. You know, we're helping community members engage and understand the policies. And we're also working directly with members of Congress to help them understand concerns that are important to the community, because we basically like you know, most, if not all members of Congress are going to have Muslim constituents, and whether right. they know it or not. And it's really important that they listen to them and ask for their opinion and consider them like they do other communities. And I think that's really what it's about. And just getting people civically engaged. And we worked with other, I started this group called the Muslim Civic Engagement Table to get Muslim civic orgs kind of working together and coordinating their efforts, because I was seeing a lot of people working in silos and repeating work. And it's me coming from a corporate background, that's really inefficient and frustrating. And one of the things that we did was we put some funding together to put a question with the ISPU survey that comes out every year, the Institute of Social Policy and nice. Understanding, to see where people were at on civic engagement. And we were seeing, you know, we had always heard that, okay, Muslims are the least engaged faith group. Yay, okay, we get that. But how much are they? And so we did a question on how many of you reached out to your member of Congress in the last year, and then how many of you reached out to your local, state, or elected officials. And yeah, the numbers were really low. It was only 17% for Congress, and I think like 20% for the local level. And so thankfully that number has gone up now, and I would like to think it is in small part due to our efforts and the efforts of so many other Muslim civic engagement orgs that have worked so hard over the last 4 years and previously. But that's kind of how we measure ourselves, and then we adjust like the strategic plan to kind of meet the needs of the community, and then also what can we do capacity wise.
Right. You know, you mentioned that, you know, you started at a prime time where this political turmoil over the last 4 years has continued, if not escalated, as we've seen. But what would you say, like, for this Biden-Harris administration, like, what are some of the key takeaways that you hope Polygon can work towards?
Well, I think one thing that we worked really heavily on was the Muslim ban. We were a part of the process of drafting the No Ban Act, collecting co-sponsors, you know, encouraging people to push it through committee, and then finally voting for it on the floor vote. And I think the Biden-Harris administration has said that they will repeal the ban on day one, which is great, and we're going to hold them to that. But there's also a lot of inner work that needs to be done, not only to prevent such a ban from being in effect again, which is why we still need to pass the No Ban Act in the Senate, but also, you know, there's a lot of, like, these visa programs and things have been very much decimated under the Trump administration. And there's going to be so many visa applications from these countries that were previously banned. People that were stuck in the pipeline before are probably going to have to, like, reapply to get through. It's going to be chaos. And so we need them to commit to making sure that institutions can handle, you know, these influx of visa applications that will happen, and as well as the legislative piece of making sure that such a ban isn't introduced ever again. So I think that's something that we're going to be really be working on. The other things that Polygon really prioritizes is domestic human needs. So we work on hunger, poverty, homelessness. And so we did a lot of work on coronavirus. So I think coronavirus obviously is going to be still here when Biden and Harris take office. And so I think holding them accountable, making sure that they are helping with relief. You know, we were really active in talking about the need to pass legislation to provide Americans relief, whether it was the CARES Act or the HEROES Act. And I think we're going to continue working on that. And I hope that it helps people realize in the community that I know, like, people think that Muslims just care about, like, foreign policy and national security. And yes, I work on that in my day job, my personal capacity, but most people, like, they care about food at their table, and they care about having a job, and they care about these, you know, these kind of basic items, in addition to probably foreign policy if they maybe come from immigrant backgrounds. But I think helping people in the administration understand that Muslims are very much a player in this, and we are concerned about the outcome of this, and then being really involved in the interfaith group. So we've done a lot of our work in interfaith coalitions, especially these domestic issues. And so I think we want to continue that and continue to be involved in the interfaith community, which I'm sure the Biden-Harris administration will engage as the Obama administration previously did. And so we really are looking forward to, like, working with them on, you know, continuing to make good policies that can help all Americans.
Nice. And then I don't know if you get this question, but often, but why the name Polygon?
Yeah, we were trying to think of a unique name that wasn't just like Muslim lobby. Like, we just didn't want something that was so obvious. So we were thinking of like strong, powerful words. You know, Polygon is, I think a thief came up with that one, and it was saying that they have like a polygon is a shape that has like multiple sides. And so we were thinking of like each of the corners of the sides could represent something like connecting people, policy, and progress, and it could build upon each other. So we were thinking of a strong symbol like that. And then eventually we changed the spelling of it to P-O-L-I to be like politics and policy instead of how it's normally spelled with a Y.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, you know, that's how we did that. And then the logo, my sister actually made the logo. She's like really good at art. And so we basically kind of inverted the one of the polygons shapes, which is like a triangle. And so, nice. Yeah, that's how we came up with that.
I was curious to know those types of things. So thanks for the insights.
Yeah. I think you remember the name, right? Like you're not going to.
For sure.
You're not going to be like, oh, what's that Muslim lobby? Like a long acronym. And no. None of that. One word.
Right. Is there anything else you want to share about Polygon?
I will just say that I think one of the challenges that we face is that exactly that, like name recognition and getting out there. You know, it's hard when you don't have, you know, well-established uncles funding you and, you know, putting you out there in their networks. Right. Like, very much built, like I said, by millennials and young people, and it's a lot of young people that are passionate about our work. And we do have some supporters in our community that we personally know that have helped us. I think we need to get to a place where it's more recognizable, so people who maybe even don't personally know us know the work that we're doing and how important it is to support. And so I think that is our biggest challenge of, you know, like just not having like, some orgs start with like a huge backing and have a lot of fanfare. We didn't do that. It was very organic. And so I'm proud of what we've been able to accomplish. But I think for us, the need is so there. It is so there. And I think we've seen that, especially with what happened in Congress and the administration this year. And I think it's just a matter of getting the community up to speed and helping to share that message about why it's important to support organizations like Polygon.
Yeah. And I think to that point as well, like even when AMCF started and even to now, like we have 20-year-olds on our board, we have 30-year-olds and 40-year-olds, you know, maybe we'll try to recruit from that 50-plus category. And, you know, we need that generational support. It's critical.
Yeah.
So also advice to people that are out there trying to start their own thing is find somebody from each decade to kind of support your work and back your work. And it's critical to have that. Would love to transition into just kind of you and the sadaqah and zakat that you personally give. Obviously, I'm certain Polygon gets your support financially as well. But what are some other causes that you like to support?
Yeah, I'm kind of the person, I've always been somebody who just kind of donates to a lot of different organizations in the Muslim civic, or not even civic nations, Muslim space and non-Muslim spaces, because I think that it's important to support, even if you can't give a ton to every single one, at least giving some. So I'm like a diversify my donations kind of person. And some of the ones that I support are my local community orgs. Like I still will give to local orgs in Houston, like the CARE Houston chapter, because I know those people and I know the hard work that they're doing. But I'll also give to the national chapter because I know those people here in DC. Right. You know, Islamic Relief does some really good relief programs. I always give to them. One organization that I don't know if a lot of people know is called Muslima Anissa. And that one is like a domestic violence shelter for Muslim women. And it just so happened that I met the founder at Zaytuna, where I was studying Arabic. And she was a student there as well. Asma Hanif. And ever since I learned about the work she was doing, and she would always be getting calls from these women that needed help and a place to stay, it just made me like really feel for them and just feel like, okay, whatever I can give to help, I'll give. So I always give to that organization. You know, there's other ones that, yeah, they're not zakat necessarily, like FACE, Aliyah Salem has started for the spiritual abuse by leaders. I think that's really important. Where else? Yeah, other Muslim civic engagement orgs as well that are doing important work. I think that every org brings something kind of unique to the table, and I think it's important that we show our support and support all of them. And then, yeah, I think I just give to other, sometimes if there's like personal appeals that people will send me, like just yesterday, one of my friends said that a family friend's son like just passed away and they need expenses for maybe the funeral. I don't know. I actually haven't even had a chance to look at the link yet, but I think he was very young and it was a tragic story. It's like I give to those kinds of things. Or I saw like the Sakina restaurant, which here in DC like gives free meals to the homeless. They were, you know, running out of funding, and so people put together a crowdfunding campaign and they raised like $200,000, which was amazing, so they could stay open. Even things like that are local, kind of like that, I'll give to. So
right.
I think it's just a way to make an impact with your funding. I think that's probably my common theme, is like, where can I make an impact with my donations? And then I also will like try to share these causes with people too on my social media so that they can learn about them and share as well, because the more people that know about them, the more people that can give and really help facilitate the mission of these organizations.
Definitely. Well, thank you for sharing that. Any other thoughts before we close out?
No, thank you for having me. This was, yes, you have something.
Yeah, for sure. Your career convos. Yeah. So talk a little bit more about that and why you started them, and we can wrap up with
yeah.
that.
Yes, yes. So my career convos started this summer. It was actually something that I had an idea to do for a while. I wanted to mentor more young people, again, with my theme of mentoring. It's just something that's really special to me. So earlier in the year, I kind of had made this goal that I want to mentor young people, mentor more. And it just so happened in the summer that I was like job searching because I was finishing my fellowship on the Hill and just having a tough time with some of the kind of some of what I was seeing, where like it was just kind of weird, where like people were not getting their worth. I was just seeing a lot of stories about like how minority staffers were not getting paid as much. And, you know, me personally, I experienced kind of something similar. And I just decided that now is the time. It's now or never. Like, you know, it's coronavirus right now. Everybody's on their phones all the time. I think this is a good time to like start this thing that I wanted to do. And it just, I think going through that experience myself made it really real about the need for it. Cause I was like, if I'm experiencing this and I'm like an empowered, educated, like qualified person, I know this, and I'm still having these issues, then how are people who don't know about these things or haven't or young or earlier in their career like gonna know how to navigate this? So that was really how Career Convos with Wartha started. I just made some Instagram videos and put them on Facebook as well, very short, less than 5 minutes each. Different things like how to ask for a raise, like how to interview for a job virtually, how to network, just really important things that I had learned through my career. Also, you know, I've hired a lot of people through Polygon. And, you know, also like earlier when I used to work for small businesses, I could help them hire staff too. So I kind of know what interviewers are looking for, what recruiters are looking for. I know what works well in an interview. And so I was like, you know, I have experience not only as a job seeker, but like an employer. And I want to help give that advice to people, because the more empowered and educated we are, the better we can stand against these kind of systems of oppression that underrepresented communities face. And, you know, this was also around the time we were seeing Black Lives Matter. And so all these stories of systemic racism were coming out. And so I was seeing that it was not something just that I was personally had experienced, but it was something that other communities of color, women, other minorities were experiencing too. And so, yeah, that was kind of how it started. And then from there, I kind of launched a career coaching business. And that was just so people could work one-on-one with me about any issues they were having, like if they wanted to practice interviewing or if they wanted to get help with their job search or know where to look. It was a way for me to help them do that. And, you know, I was just telling you earlier, like I had a session last night, and it just feels really good to be able to help people with their issues and getting feedback from people saying that, you know, this was like my boss said I had given them the best interview they had ever seen, and that I got multiple offers after working with me when before they weren't getting any. You know, it feels really nice to be able to help people. And it's not only young people, you know, it's people my age or older who also maybe are looking to transition careers or transition sectors that need some help and guidance. And so I feel really fortunate that I can help offer that and help guide them. And it's a lot of fun for me to see results. And I never thought that I never imagined turning it into a business or doing anything like that. But when I see how much need is out there, I'm really glad that I'm doing it, because it's just a great way that I can help people.
Yeah, you know, the videos are really succinct. I've enjoyed watching every single one. I'm rooting for you. The coaching sounds really great, and I know can be really useful for people in this space, just to continue to bounce ideas off of people and have that mentorship and advice from someone who's been through it. So definitely continue that. And where can people find the Career Convos with Wertha?
Yeah, so they can go to my Instagram, which is at @WerthaKhalid_. They're also on my Facebook page. I think it's facebook.com/, I think it's WerthaKhalid55 is my handle on my public page. And then on my website, WerthaKhalid.com, and there's a tab called Career Coaching, and then it has some sample videos there, as well as like the services that I can provide and how they can book a free consultation with me to talk about their needs.
Awesome. Well, Wertha, this has been really enlightening, and I really thank you for your time and sharing your story with AMCF. I wish you all the best and really appreciate you being on.
Thank you so much. Same to you. And thank you for doing this and giving people a platform and, you know, helping to share these diverse voices. So thank you so much.
Definitely. That's what we're here at AMCF to do, to kind of uplift other organizations and let more people know about them. So happy to do it. All right. Take care.
You too.